Hello and welcome to Sports Community Radio Show, produced in the studios of RPPFM 98.7, 98.3 FM, the voice of the peninsula. My name is Joe Novella, and along with my co-host Steve Pallas, we'll bring you the latest news and information from the world of grassroots sport so you can help your club succeed. And after the show, why not visit our website at www.sportscommunity.com.au to view all our previous podcasts and free resources on a broad range of topics, including grants, fundraising, and sponsorship. And while you're there, make sure to sign up for our newsletter so you can stay on top of all the resources available to help make your club successful. Welcome to the show, Steve.
G'day, Joe. How are you going today?
I am going very, very well. Now, one of the hot buttons always on our social media channels is grants, and there's been a lot of activity around a few of the grants that we've posted recently. You want to have a chat about grants?
Well, I did, Joe. I did indeed. And there's a lot of grants now opening from all around the country, and most times each week we list a few. So from our website, and we will do that a little bit later in the show, just to give you a bit of a taste of what is open at the moment, and also the different providers, grant providers, because it's not just government. There's corporates out there, philanthropics, and foundations. So there's a lot of places for people to get money. But I had the privilege of sitting in on a consultation discussion facilitated by La Trobe Uni that was getting feedback from the sports industry about the Vic Health grants. And from memory, what they were saying was about 30% of applications that they receive, and they get heaps, don't even qualify for the grant. So, because each grant has a guideline, it has a purpose, and what they're saying is 30% of the grants that they receive, they don't even consider, because for one, either what the grant is for doesn't qualify for what the club has requested doesn't qualify for what the grant is for, or they just haven't supplied all the information that the grant provider has been looking for. And that was a huge amount. I mean, they were talking in the hundreds of people, hundreds of clubs submitted grants that just simply didn't qualify. So, and they simply didn't consider. So when you think about that from an hour's point of view, Joe, that's a lot of work that's just completely wasted.
Absolutely.
You know, and so that got me really thinking about clubs and how they, you know, they just apply for grants. So just a couple of tips on grants that came out of the consultation session that they did run was that if you're going to apply for a grant, make sure you read the guidelines that are associated with each grant. Very rarely is a grant offered to the community that don't come with a set of guidelines, you know, that tells us what the grant's for, what's eligible, what's not eligible, what they're looking for, what they're trying to achieve by giving your club the money. So if you've got often clubs would apply for, if it was a participation type grant, they'd apply for things like laptops. And yes, there is a link to how a laptop can increase participation, but most clubs didn't make that link. What they said is, you've got money and we need a laptop. You've got money, we need equipment. You've got money, we need this. We know you've asked for certain things, but this is what we need, so this is what we're going to ask for and we're going to apply for. But it's really important now that clubs understand that if they don't meet the criteria in the guidelines, they're not even going to be considered. And it's just not worth wasting a second of your time if your grant application doesn't satisfy what the government or what the grant provider is going to do. So that's the first thing that came out of that session, Joe, was to look at and read the guidelines. They were amazed at when they went back and talked to the clubs that submitted non-compliant applications, how many of them hadn't even looked at the guidelines and, in fairness, didn't even know that the guidelines existed. So that was the first obvious thing that came out of it. And the second obvious thing that came out of it was if the grant is requesting two quotes, or if they're requesting financial statements, or if they're requesting annual reports, you have to give it to them. And if you don't give it to them, then it's effectively a non-complying application, and they just won't. If they've got lots and lots of applications, they just won't consider it. They certainly won't go back if they've got hundreds of grants that don't are missing bits of information. They're not going to go back to the clubs and say, hey, you haven't given us your annual report, or you haven't given us two quotes, or you haven't given us your financial statements, or you haven't given us your club rules, or whatever it is we've asked for. They're just going to say, non-complying, which is, again, just a tremendous waste of time. And for the volunteers, Joe, collecting all those ancillary pieces of information can often take a huge amount of time, and clubs don't realise that until they get to the end of their application, which inevitably is a bit like a school assignment in many cases. They do it just before it's finished because that's what happens with us humans. And then they realise that they've got, like, they need all this ancillary information and just don't have time to get it, so they submit the grant application. So where you should start, look at the guidelines, look at what the purpose of the grant is for, but then look at what they need. It won't just be the grant application itself. There may be supporting information, which will take some time. Letters of endorsements from other community groups, from schools. There's quite a lot of things that the grant providers may request. So be wary of those. They take a bit of time. Now, Joe, on our website, we've probably got about 60 or 70 grants, I think, open at the moment. But the one big area of grant provider that we don't list on our website is local councils, because I think around Australia there's something like 570 of them, and we just don't have the time, the resources to look at what the councils are offering at any given time. But I did see in our local paper this week that our local council, the Mornington Peninsula Shire, they're offering government grants up to $5,000 for two community organisations for various reasons. Now, $5,000 is not insignificant. So, and the pool of people that can apply for that is a lot less. It's just limited to your club, your municipality. So council grants are often the grants that are undersubscribed because A, people don't know about them, and B, they don't apply for them. So those that do apply are often have a lot higher success rates than the larger state, federal government, corporate grants. So if you're at the start of the year, or if you're looking for grants, then I'd really, really strongly suggest that that you contact or look at your council website, because all council websites, or just about all, have grant pages, what grants are available. Have a look what they've got, when they're open, and then if you've got a special need for an event or an activity or a plan or a strategy or to increase participation, then regardless of whether the grant's open or not, then just go and talk to the sport and rec representative at your local council, because they are there to help, and they are often staggered at how few people actually ring them. So easy way to get some money, I reckon, Joe, with the right method and the right technique and the right time allocated.
Absolutely. Now, during the week, we had a watershed event at Sports Community in that we delivered our first online training to folks in the Pilbara region of Australia, believe it or not. So our headquarters are in Mornington here in Victoria in Australia, and we delivered online training via online hookup to a group of councils in Western Australia. So that is a remarkable technological advance that has enabled companies like us to extend our reach when it comes to training, and for us it was a great moment for the company to be able to service some of the remote folks that would not normally have access to this type of training. So it was great, wasn't it, mate?
Great, yeah. I found it quite stressful, actually, Joe. We had just to set the scene, we had one group of people where were they? Tom Price. And they could see us and they could hear us, and we could see them and we could hear them. And then we had two or three other venues throughout the Pilbara where the they could see and hear what we were doing on the screen and what I was saying, but we could neither see nor hear them. So the only way that they could communicate with us was through, I guess, a chat function within the technology, which is pretty cool. And so, but for a mere male like my good self, Joe, who's not, you know, I quite put up there that I'm not overly good at doing one thing at a time, let alone three things at a time. So I really struggled with trying to work out the technology, trying to remember what was coming up in the presentation, and then trying to interact with all the different sites, some of which we could see and some of which we couldn't see. So
I think you've been a bit harsh on yourself. I was there, and it was very, very well delivered, I thought. And if take a minute or so to talk about the technology for those folks out there that are listening, this technology enables us to have a group of people anywhere in Australia, in fact, the world. Who can hook up to a meeting which we set up on the internet in cyberspace, and we are able to see them and they are able to see us. And not only that, but we can then share our screen, so we can have slides or presentations which we can share with people that attend the course. We can share documents so people can download documentation. We can have quizzes and polls. We can even have a whiteboard. So
they can even just ask a question as if they're in the room with this joke.
So it effectively a classroom environment, but held on the internet, which is unbelievable for a lot of us who are of the older vintage, and just explodes the possibilities for grassroots volunteer training in this country, not only in this country, but around the world, because we can now effectively have people from all over Australia joining in on our courses, or there's a lot of different terminology out there. People might call them webinars, they might call them online training, but basically it's all about joining a forum where you can participate in a training event on just by sitting at your computer, and we have that ability. And I thought the actual course, the first course that we kicked off with for the folks in the Pilbara, and I must add there was something that I knew that I learned, and that was that Ashburton is the largest shire in Australia. I'd hate to think how big it is, but it is the largest shire in Australia.
East Pilbara, that was, Joe.
Oh, was it?
Not Ashburton.
Oh, okay, East Pilbara. I do beg your pardon. It's probably about twice the size of Victoria, one council shire, that is.
Yeah, we've got to get those right. If they're proud of their titles, yeah, we need to get that right, rightly so.
Yeah, and I thought the first online training course that we started off with was very interesting. It was delivered to council staff, and it was all about reducing conflict in committees, and you prepared this and you delivered it. What are some of the key points that you wanted to really emphasise for those folks in the councils in the Pilbara?
Well, before we go back to the content of the session, Joe, like one of the things that as we were working through the session, one of the things I realised was it means really that when we have a clubs don't need to get together physically to meet now. Like, we've always had teleconference, but the reality is, Joe, that with the advent of the way the internet has expanded, and there's so much more bandwidth, for want of better terminology, where information and video and can move up and down very, very, very quickly, and the NBN is really designed to change the way we communicate, with a lot more things being able to go online, it occurred to me that it has the potential, with what's happening with technology now, to change the way the clubs operate forever. Like, it's often very, very difficult for clubs to find time, for committees to find time, to actually meet together in the one place, because the world is a lot smaller now. There's nothing for committee members to be all around the country or the world at any one time. You know, look at our staff. I mean, who knows? Well, next week we're in Darwin, and the week after we've got people in Brisbane, and a couple of weeks after that we've got people back in the Pilbara. And then we're all over the state doing training at 16 or 17 locations. So very difficult for us to even get people into that one spot at one time. So it really opens up the the ability for committees to meet online in an online meeting place using technology that's free, like Google Hangouts and Skype. I think can have up to five people hanging there. So Joe, that was one of the main. We might hold over the discussion next week because we've got. Got to really about what the session was about conflict in committees, because I'm really, really keen to talk about what came out of that session. But we'll hold that over to the next week, because in a couple of minutes' time we've got a really interesting guest from the Australian New Zealand Sports Law Association. But yeah, look, the way that technology is moving and what we can do with technology. And I was talking with the guys from Cricket Victoria. About that meeting in the Pilbara, and they said, "Yeah, we use that same technology to run a coaching clinic for kids in remote areas as well. Where there was a clinic run in Melbourne, and then there was televisions and a clinic run. And I can't remember the regional location. And we ran the clinic in two locations with one coach in one location doing all the teaching." And then coaches at the other location just facilitating the exercises, and I think now we're seeing live streaming becoming more commonplace within sports at a grassroots level, where we're streaming the games and the competitions themselves. But I think that technology, Joe, that has real potential to also streamline the way we do the back end. So we really look forward to launching a whole range of webinar training series over the next coming months, but even more importantly than that, start to use this online technology and see what you can and can't do with it, because I genuinely think it has the opportunity to revolutionise the way that we communicate and interact with people inside and outside our club, Jay. So that's just my two bobs worth.
You're listening to Sports Community Radio with your hosts, Joe Novella and Steve Pallas. If you've missed a couple of our episodes, why not visit our website at www.sportscommunity.com.au, and there you'll find all our previous podcasts that you can download. And while you're there, give us a review so you can help spread the news about Sports Community and its services to the grassroots sports clubs. Okay, welcome back. We've got a very special guest with us today. Her name is Venetia Stewart. She is the president of the Australia and New Zealand Sports Law Association. Welcome to the show, Venetia.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hi, Venetia. Steve Pallas, thank you so much for coming on. The Australian and New Zealand Sports Law Association, do you want to just give us a little bit of background? Obviously, it's got to do with law, but a little bit of background as to what it is and how you get involved within support the sports industry.
Yeah, absolutely, Steve. More than happy to do that. So ANSLA, which is what we like to call it, is a member-based not-for-profit association. We operate across Australia and New Zealand, but have members drawn from around the world. You might see, if you visit our website, that ANSLA is dedicated to providing education, advocacy and networking opportunities about legal issues in sport. Now, I know that sounds like a bit of a mouthful, but we've put some thought into it because those three pillars are really important to supporting the sports industry to understand the legal issues that arise. We have membership that includes lawyers, administrators, government representatives, academics, and also students. So it's basically the full gamut of the sports industry. But really, membership's open to anyone who's got an interest in the legal issues in sport. What ANSLA does offer to members and also to the sports industry more generally are education resources. There's a huge suite of information available on the website relating to cases that are relevant to sport, legislation that applies, articles, research papers, but then what most of our members enjoy best are the networking opportunities. So we run regional seminars around Australia and New Zealand and an annual conference, which inevitably has a lot of really interesting discussion around the current issues in sport.
So, well, let's go and find out what those current issues are, just generally in Australian, well, in sport, and then we'll delve down to the grassroots level. But just generally, what are the big issues that you see and ANSLA see? And just for our listeners, the website is ANSLA, ANZSLA sport.com. But what are the big issues in sport that you are seeing at the moment?
Well, I think you're absolutely right in breaking it down to the grassroots level as against the professional level.
Yeah.
The professional level's been in the news quite a lot over the last couple of years about a concept called integrity. Now, integrity covers a number of different aspects of sport, but the ones that have been attracting the most attention in the back pages of the newspaper have been performance-enhancing drugs or doping.
Yep.
And match fixing and illegal sports betting. But neither of those two issues are really at the forefront of what I understand grassroots sports are dealing with on a day-to-day basis. So whilst they're attracting a lot of public attention, it's perhaps not so relevant to the clubs and community sport level. What we did, I think it was towards middle to end of last year, ANSLA ran a survey in conjunction with Play by the Rules, and we asked sports what legal issues they were facing at the time, and there were three that really stood out as the top three. Firstly, governance and sports clubs and associations rules and constitutions. There seemed to be a little bit of confusion around how rules are to apply, and more importantly, it was evident that a lot of clubs hadn't updated their rules for a good number of years. Another really big issue, which sort of came out of left field because we weren't expecting it, was working with children seemed to be an issue that a lot of grassroots clubs were facing. And I understand that if you're a club that's dealing with children on a day-to-day basis, there's a raft of legislation that you have to get across. So I do understand why that's posing a few issues for clubs. And then thirdly, something that jumped out, which we were expecting, is clubs are really concerned about risk management and liability, whether that's around the venues that they use, injuries, or just managing their members.
Brilliant. And that, I guess that was one of that research was what I guess raised our awareness of ANSLA and the work that you were doing in the research space. So did it? Is they're the issues that have been raised, and they are certainly grassroots issues, and Play by the Rules is a fantastic organisation, and we've had Peter Downs on this very radio show. He's been fantastic from a whole range of areas. But what's the next step now that you've identified these three key areas, which are very consistent with what we experience out working with clubs every day?
From ANSLA's perspective, we like to join with other bodies that are in the sports industry, whether it's the Departments of Sport and Rec or the Sports Federation or Play by the Rules itself, to really try to educate the grassroots community. We understand that there's not a great deal of time and resources that members and particularly volunteers can devote to chasing rabbits down holes about issues. So we'd like to put as much information out there as possible. And there are places that sports and clubs can go when they do need some information and a bit of help in a certain area.
So what sort of places, where are those places that you would recommend for clubs to go?
Well, obviously, I can say that ANSLA's got a great resource in terms of its website, but they're quite legal and specific issues that, the issues that I raised before. For example, working with children is quite a specific issue, and given the differences between the legislation in each state, it's probably best off going to your local sports federation.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the WA Sports Federation offers a great service in terms of working with children assistance. Or the Department of Sport and Rec in your state as well. Play by the Rules is obviously a fantastic resource. They've got a great suite of information on their website as well, particularly in the dispute resolution space.
Yeah, member protection, definitely. And so what about risk management? Because risk management really is an area that clubs, they're not too bad from a player protection type perspective, but anything else is quite foreign to them. So where do you recommend that clubs go from a risk management perspective?
Again, I think the sports federations have a really good have really good information available to clubs and may be able to assist at a basic level. But also local governments. I know that a lot of clubs and associations are run using local government resources and particularly the facilities and increasing interactions and relationships between local government and the sport where you are can often be very helpful for understanding your obligations as a club or as a sport and what lies with the local government authority. Insurance and your insurer and your insurance policy can also really assist, and also just attending risk management seminars. I think getting as many people on your board or committees or even your volunteers up to speed with the knowledge of what to look out for and what checks to conduct before, for example, stepping out onto a field, it can really assist in that way.
Going back to the mission of ANSLA, which is to provide education, advocacy, networking opportunities about legal issues in sport in Australia and New Zealand. So from an advocacy point of view, what are the issues that you're picking up that advocacy type role within for sports?
ANSLA is actually in quite an interesting position because our membership covers everyone involved in sport. So we try not to advocate for a particular position on a particular issue. For example, when the amendments were proposed to the ASADA legislation, we obviously have members who are based at ASADA. We have members based in sport, and we also have athletes as members. So ANSLA is very keen on advocating for an awareness of legal issues and advocating for certain positions, but won't take a side where there's a genuine debate. One issue that ANSLA is advocating very strongly for is providing a very good and cost-effective dispute resolution mechanism in Australia.
Brilliant.
So at the moment, New Zealand has a dedicated sports tribunal. Australia doesn't have a similar centre for resolving disputes. What's happened as a result of that is individual states are adopting their own approach to dispute resolution. South Australia has set up a dispute resolution centre. Western Australia has also set up a dispute resolution service. And what we're worried about from ANSLA's perspective is having divergent approaches around Australia so that sports don't have any consistency between the different states that they might operate in.
Yeah, and that's a challenge that grassroots sports has all the time because Incorporated Association is a state-based level. Well, the Incorporated Association Act's state-based, food handling, liquor licensing, fundraising, all state-based legislations, which certainly does create issues from time to time, particularly for those clubs that are on the borders and cross over into different jurisdictions, so to speak. But
absolutely. And I guess the one thing that we always tell sports to go back to, whether it's in my capacity at ANSLA or whether it's in my capacity as a lawyer, is to go back to your rules and your own procedures to determine how to resolve a dispute. So they will be your best port of call in whenever an issue arises with a member or where there's a grievance that arises between members.
Yeah, it's staggering. We often, that's where we get involved when there's disputes at a club level, and I'm just staggered at the number of times that the club's own rules people weren't aware of them, let alone followed them. So that's we're very strong in that. Go back to the rules and administer your club by the rules.
Oh, absolutely. And that was certainly something that came through in the responses to the survey that we had in 2014. A number of clubs hadn't revised or reviewed even their rules since the 1990s, and there have been a huge number of changes in terms of just regulation that probably ought to be embodied in rules over the past 20 years.
Oh, absolutely. Well, there's one change I just want to touch on and get your thoughts at from a legal perspective, and maybe it's a guessing where this is going to go, but one of the things that has changed dramatically in the last 5, 6, 7 years is the use of social media. And do you see the use of social media as creating legal issues for peak bodies, for athletes, for sports themselves, for the different people, as it becomes more prevalent and more highly used within in society, or you don't see it as really an issue?
Well, despite having been around now for a good number of years and people are becoming quite used to social media avenues like Facebook and LinkedIn and Instagram, I think generally it's causing a bit of a headache around society still. Mm. I still don't think that anyone, whether you're young, old or in between, has a real grasp on the implications of social media and how it's used from the way that society operates, let alone how sport operates. But absolutely, social media is an issue that a lot of sports, and particularly at a club level, are trying to grasp with at the moment. What we see as an issue in particular has been bullying and harassment through social media, which is obviously very difficult to control because social media and a person's use of social media isn't necessarily for a sporting purpose,
mm.
but where you might have two members that are involved in sport and a dispute arises that's then played out on social media, that can have implications for a club or a team. What we can really only suggest in terms of managing social media is to for sports and clubs and associations to have a policy as to how social media can and should be used, and what is and isn't allowed under that policy will then determine what your expectations are of members. The important thing about having a policy in place is that it has to be enforced.
Yeah.
So you can use a policy effectively as a contract with your members, and if a member breaches that contract or does something that is against the terms of the policy, you can take action to enforce the policy against the member, and you might set out sanctions, you might have a period of suspension from the club, you might have some other way of disciplining the person for their actions. Perhaps it's an apology, a public apology or private apology to the person that was involved. But that's really the only way that we can inform a sport to proceed when they have social media issues that they're grappling with. But I really think it all comes down to something that's not particularly legal, and that's education.
Yes.
I think people are learning more and more that it's just not okay to go out and abuse people on social media, but it will take time, I think, for society to adjust to how it uses social media. And the more education that a sport can provide to its members about what is and isn't okay, the better.
The social media policy, and we couldn't agree with you more on that topic. Do you know where there's a good template, or do clubs make it up themselves, or?
To be honest, I don't think I have seen one in particular that's jumped out as a template that all sports should use, but I have seen a couple of good ones, for example, at Football West in WA. And I think our own firm's social media policy is fairly directive about what we can and can't write publicly about other colleagues and people at the firm. I think, honestly, it would depend on what's important to the club. Yeah. A club that has a really robust membership may encourage discussion. They may create their own forum for discussion about issues. But if you are going to set up a site or a discussion forum or a blog or a page, I think there has to be someone at the club that will monitor it and have authority to remove offensive posts. And when someone's doing so, they need to have the discretion and absolute discretion to make those decisions themselves as to what should and shouldn't be allowed on the site.
Yeah, absolutely. That can't just leave clubs' social media pages or forums unmoderated. That's for sure. We've seen that happen quite a lot, and to the detriment of the club or the association. So, yeah, couldn't agree with you more. I'm going to have a look at the Football West. And the other one was your own Ansler policy. Was that the other one that you just mentioned there?
No, it's actually our firm's policy, so I'm sure that one's not public. But it's one of those things that I really think the people involved in the sport or the club need to sit down and figure out what applies to them. So if a sport or club won't offer an interactive forum, then obviously that removes one of the risks.
Mm.
Of social media, But if they do want to encourage that discussion and that connection with the association, then they may want to offer a forum, in which case it should obviously be highly regulated and monitored.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, going back to the start of the interview, you said that the major issues that you were involved with or seeing was the match fixing and performance enhancing. Do you see that there is a time or that those will be issues within grassroots sport as well?
To be honest, I think they already are, but at a level that's not been reported, and I don't think that anyone knows the true extent of. There have been rumours and innuendo about the increasing use of performance-enhancing drugs at a local sport level, and not even necessarily for the intention of enhancing performance in sport, but there are rumours that it's actually to look good or for cosmetic reasons. So I think that these issues, which again are probably more societal issues than sport-related issues, will necessarily apply to grassroots sports in the future.
Yeah, well, I think when we spoke with ASADA earlier in the year, they said that the number of customs interceptions had significantly increased, that were going down and eventually ending up in grassroots sports for the performance in, well, a lot of the time people don't think it's performance enhancing, but it's an illegal supplement. But what about the match fixing? Do you see that as being an issue at grassroots sport? And I guess match fixing only is an issue where betting's involved. So, and that may be naive as well. But do you see match fixing as being an issue in the grassroots sporting sector or the community sports as, or non-professional sport, I guess?
Yeah, I do. And, I mean, the Victorian example last year of the Southern Stars, the year before of the Southern Stars, was a prime example of that. Whilst it was a semi-professional league, the VPL, it does indicate that there is match-fixing exposure for sports at tiers below the top tier of sport. And I think that is a risk for grassroots sports, and then the question is, how do you manage that risk? Mm. Because obviously resources at a volunteer level are stretched already, and to add another few things to everyone's to-do list is hardly going to be well received and very easy to manage. But at the same time, there is a risk. There is a risk, I think, posed by match fixing. I understand that when the Victorian Police Sports Integrity Investigations Unit were looking at the VPL issue, they found that Australian sports leagues, whether it's a professional league or sub-professional league and grassroots levels, are particularly attractive for match fixing on the illegal betting markets in Southeast Asia in particular, because they're renowned for being clean. So the strength of our sporting competition is ultimately where it's most vulnerable, because if you can find someone that's willing to make a few bob on the side, there is an exposure for grassroots sport.
Yeah, and certainly at grassroots sport, there's not the controls that there is up in the professional stakes. And, I mean, even in the... We're seeing... I mean, in the last 24 hours, there's been the sensational disclosure of some greyhound racing practices regarding to live bait that's supposed to have been outlawed for 20 and 30 years. So professional sports have those challenges. So how do you think that clubs can deal with some of these challenges that we think are inevitably going to come as well? We think they're already there, the same as what you indicated. So how does grassroots sports prepare for itself and to a degree protect itself?
Yeah, and it is a very difficult question because there's so many issues that surround it. But to start with, and this would be the case for most sports that have a national affiliate, having an anti-match-fixing template within the sport's rules,
yes,
is a starting point.
Yes.
That will govern the conduct of members and give the sport something to rely on if they suspect that something's gone awry. And also just being a little bit savvy. I know it sounds naive, but quite often a gut feeling takes you further than necessarily a detailed investigation, because you can get a feel for when something's not quite right, when someone's performance isn't where it should be at a inexplicable level, where there's subterfuge and secret conversations going on. I think there's a lot of things that can trigger a club to think that maybe something's not quite right and to investigate further.
Well, and that investigation could just be going to the association and or to the Peak Sporting Body, isn't it? It is about being alert to these things that we just haven't had to worry about in the past. But I think you've raised a really good point. It's these little signs and triggers that are, when you look back at the cases that are coming to light, that they are characteristic, aren't they, in those cases? And so I guess that's what we do need to look for.
Yeah, absolutely. And using the Southern Stars example again, I think it was other teams that commented that there were some really strange things going on the field that didn't make any sense. And then ultimately the FFA were the ones that reported the potential match fixing to the Victoria Police, because they'd had the tip-off from Sport Radar, which is a sports betting monitoring agency.
Yes.
So that might, Sport Radar might not pick up monitoring or betting at a grassroots level. Mm. But that doesn't mean that everyone can't be on the lookout for the signs that might give away a potential issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, speaking of potential issues, one of the things that we know intuitively well, intimately well working with clubs, is that in certain areas they don't want to spend any money. one of those areas is rarely player payments. I'm happy to spend lots of money. But for legal issues, clubs are loath to spend any money, and often to their own detriment. And often they find themselves in situations that if they had got legal advice and a bit of legal opinion and a little bit of direction a lot earlier on in the piece, they would save themselves a lot of work, heartache, expense, relationships not being shattered and those sorts of things. What are the areas that most commonly that you see that from a grassroots level where clubs really should be trying to seek a little bit of support to stop things escalating?
Yeah, and I think you've absolutely hit the nail on the head about seeking advice early, because that can so often avoid issues spiralling out of control, which ultimately, of course, drain resources and increase costs in the long run.
Mm.
Complaint management and complaint handling is one area where I think clubs would be well advised to seek advice early. The earlier that you can look to resolve a complaint, make sure that it's being resolved through the channels set out in the sport zone procedures. It's amazing how quickly complaints can spiral out of control if they're not managed properly.
Yes.
So that would certainly be one area that I'd suggest get taking advice. And also, risk management is another potential area where sports might like to take advice if they don't feel like they're equipped to deal with the issues themselves. It's more about prevention rather than addressing an issue when it actually arises, because by then sometimes the ball's already rolling down the hill.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's about, how quickly can you stop it, not how big can it get. So looking forward then, what are the issues that you see on the horizon? And let's start with professional sport, because that's potentially where you spend a lot more of your time, but and drift then into the grassroots. But what do you see coming our way? What are the new challenges and the new, I guess, areas of risk?
I think match fixing, we may have just seen the tip of the iceberg to date. There's been an increasing number of stories uncovered internationally about match fixing in the past and also in the present. And there are exposures for Australia. I can recall Declan Hill, who's the author of a book about match fixing called The Fix, who spoke at the ANZL conference in 2009 saying that Australia and New Zealand were mad if they didn't think that match fixing was going to come to our shores, because we are so close to Asia and on the same time zone. So I think at a professional level certainly, and also to some extent at a grassroots level, that will likely be one of the issues that keeps popping its head up over the next few years. And then at a more practical level, I think sports are needing to deal with a new generation who perhaps don't have the same background of growing up watching watching sport live or watching the television together with family. Instead, they can access sport in a very different way to what you and I and our parents are used to. So engaging that generation, developing products and sporting products that are attractive to them is an issue that I think the major sports are going to face as well.
Oh, it's certainly an issue that the major sports have really grappled with, coming up with product that the young generation or the newest participants in their sport, they want to participate in a time that they want to participate at a place and with the people that they want to participate with. I think that's a very, very, very astute observation that the traditional sporting structure is not as attractive to the next generation as it was to the last generation, I guess. So
yeah, and the struggle will be making one product attractive to everyone, and it'll be interesting to see how sports grapple with that.
It will be indeed. Now, just as before we let you go, a majority or a large majority of our audience are on committees of sports clubs, and so a very large group of that group are on the committees for the first time. So if you're just going to give one word of advice to an incoming president of a sporting club, what would that be?
I think it will be what we've touched on a number of times in our discussion, and that would be to read your constitution. Make sure that you know what the sport's about, what its rules and bylaws are, particularly what its grievance procedures and disciplinary procedures involve, and start there. And secondly, to surround yourself with good people, because it's important to have the support. And if you don't know everything, and of course no one does, have someone on your committee who can fill in the gaps.
Brilliant. I think we run a training session called "So You're on the Committee Now What?" And we ask people in the crowd what's the very first thing they do, and that's what we tell them as well. So I'm very, very relieved that we're consistent with the Australian and New Zealand Sports Law Association. So Venetia Stewart, thank you so much for sharing half an hour of your very valuable time. It's given us a great insight into what's happening at the professional level, but also for us at grassroots level, what we need to look at. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Steve and Joe. And just before I go, I should say to your members that ANSLA does have on its website a legal contact list, which is a list of our members who your members can feel free to contact if they do require legal advice. And there's also a list of tribunal members which can be accessed through contacting our executive manager, Sharon Scriven. So if one of your members or listeners has an issue that requires an independent tribunal member, then they will surely find someone who'd be happy to assist on that list.
Brilliant. So just for the listeners again, the ANSLA website address is?
www.ansla.com.
And are you on any social media at all?
We are. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter and also Facebook.
Very good. So just search those social media platforms and you'll be able to find ANSLA. And Joe's been reading the through your website for the whole session, which would explain his complete lack of contribution. But great resource for clubs, and again, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you again for having me, Steve, and thanks very much, Joe.
You're listening to Sports Community Radio with your hosts, Steve Pellis and Joe Novella, another Sports Community digital production, courtesy of www.sportscommunity.com.au. Okay, thanks for joining us today on the Sports Community Radio Show, produced in the fantastic studios of RPPFM 98.7, 98.3 FM on your dial, the voice of the peninsula. You can access all our previous podcasts at www.sportscommunity.com.au, as well as a world of great content, including free resources to help your club with fundraising, sponsorship, growing your membership, and all the other challenges that come with running a volunteer sports club. And while you're there, you can subscribe to our newsletter to help You keep up to date with all the latest news in the world of grassroots sports, including the latest grants that are available to your club. You can also stay connected with us via our Facebook page and our Twitter feed, and you can contact us at jointheshow@sportscommunity.com.au. We hope you've enjoyed the show, and on behalf of me, Joe Novella,
and me, Steve Pallas, thank you for making us part of your sports community.
Sports Community podcast and radio show is produced in the studios of RPPFM 98.3, 98.7, The Voice of the Peninsula.